This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Until both sides are convinced that there's no way to militarily win the conflict or to militarily gain an advantage over their opponents, it's difficult to see why they would agree to compromise or to negotiate.
That's Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, on the challenge of resolving Libya's conflict. Details coming up. Also, a measles outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo has killed more than 6,000 people, most of them children. And mortar rounds rain down on a military base for UN, French, and Malian forces today in northern Mali's restive Kidal region. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, several international moves are underway to secure a ceasefire in Libya and start negotiations for a political solution. Russia and Turkey agreed to call for a ceasefire in the battered country, effective at Sunday midnight. The European Union also called for a ceasefire, while the foreign ministers of Egypt, France, Cyprus, and Greece urged a political solution and supported the proposed Berlin conference as a start for dialogue between the warring parties. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the multi-pronged pressure on what would it take to secure a political solution in Libya with Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis.
Although I think both parties are certainly becoming tired of the conflict, it's taken a large toll in terms of numbers of deaths, destructions, just the resources needed to carry on the conflict. There aren't really any clear indications that either side is genuinely willing to negotiate. So although there sometimes is talk of ceasefires or striking negotiations, these are still based on the same red lines that were issued back when the conflict started. So on the GNA's side, they say, you know, we would be willing to talk or enter a ceasefire, but only if the LNA and Haftar's forces withdraw from Tripoli and revert to their initial positions. Likewise, Haftar and his forces continue to say that they're willing to have a political solution, but only if the militias and now sort of the Turkish elements also withdraw from Tripoli. So in reality, there's no clear signs by either side that they're actually willing to make any of the concessions or compromises necessary to really make any kind of dialogue work.
But now Russia and Turkey agreed to call for a ceasefire in Libya effective Sunday midnight. Would that work, considering that Russia is backing the Libyan National Army and Turkey is backing the GNA?
On one sense, I think the fact that both Turkey and Russia have a significant role on opposing sides of the conflict is a reason why they could have some influence. In that aspect, that could have an impact. However, the practicality is another question. With Turkey, they are the main sole supplier of arms and weapons and military capacity to the GNA. So on the one hand, if they sort of put pressure on and said we're going to halt or not deliver new supplies to the GNA forces, that could pressure those forces to strike a ceasefire. However, on the GNA side, there are multiple militias. Many of them don't answer directly to the GNA. So it's not clear that even if Turkey made that decision and tried to put the pressure on, whether that would be implemented. On the Haftar and LNA side, if Haftar issued a ceasefire, it's much more likely to be applied by all of his forces as a stronger hierarchy. Russia is only one of many countries actively providing military support and capacity to the LNA. So, for example, if the UAE, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, if none of those countries agree with the Russian proposed ceasefire, then actually the pressure required to implement that ceasefire is unlikely to take place.
Could the international pressure provide a chance for Germany to succeed in its effort to bring the fighting to an end and pave the way for a political solution?
The problem with the Berlin process, the German push to try and reach an international consensus on how to end the conflict in Libya. It has largely stalled since the end of last year, partly because of the escalation with Turkey and Turkey agreeing to send troops and the escalation in kind of proxy warfare dimensions on the ground. And as you mentioned with the Turkey and Russia initiative, and there are just so many different international players actively involved in Libya. And unfortunately, you know, many of the European countries and others have been saying for many years, as well as recently, that they support a political solution. The political solution is the only way forward, but really haven't been able to translate that into any kind of real pressure or momentum on the ground. And if Turkey and Russia are kind of going and doing their, you know, a different thing, if particularly countries like the UAE and Egypt are not on board with either of these processes, then it's very difficult to see how that's going to translate to a meaningful reality on the ground.
So what would it take to secure a political solution in Libya?
I think that the UN-backed Berlin process is along the right ideas. I think that at the moment, the main trend that's escalating and intensifying the conflict is the fact that both Libyan parties are receiving arms and training and mercenaries and funding. So I think a political solution does need to start, on the one hand, forcing a UN arms embargo as a starting point. On the Libyan side, in terms of getting the Libyan parties to the negotiating table, until both sides are convinced that there's no way to militarily win the conflict or to militarily gain an advantage over their opponents, it's difficult to see why they would agree to compromise or to negotiate.
And that was VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy speaking with Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis. A measles outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo has killed more than 6,000 people, most of them children. The DRC Health Ministry is working with international agencies to fight the highly contagious virus. Dr. Guillaume Ngoya Mwamba is the director of the DRC's expanded immunization program. He spoke today with my colleague Jason Patinkin.
The last year, from the 1st of January to 29th of December, we have 311,471 cases, cumulative cases, and 6,045 cumulative deaths. It shows that we have a mortality of 1.9%.
And is that a very high mortality compared to other outbreaks? Obviously, 6,000 deaths is a very high number.
Yeah, this year there is so high because we have accumulated a lot of number of non-vaccinated children in routine immunization.
And so what are the main challenges now to getting this outbreak under control?
Yeah, the main challenge is a financial one, because we need enough money to buy vaccine for routine immunization and to have sufficient money to buy a vaccine for response to outbreak.
And what figure are we talking about? How much money is needed for the Ministry of Health, for the WHO, for the various organizations?
For the routine immunization, we need 80 million for routine immunization dollars. But for outbreaks, our different partners, we did a plan that need 40 million dollars for 6 months to control these outbreaks.
And what is happening now? What does the response look like now? What's being done now?
Last year, in 179 health zones, we vaccinated 5 million children, but we did also supplementary immunization activities. And you will see that for those activities, the outbreak is going down and down
Got it. Thank you very much. Is there anything else you would like to add?
The thing we are going to have is to ask the parents to go with their children to the routine immunization. The children who have under than a year of old, they must go and with their children to routine immunization.
And that was Dr. Guliam Ngoi Mwamba, who leads the DRC's expanded immunization program in the fight against measles. He was speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. A UN report says a barrage of mortar rounds rained down on a military base for UN, French and Malian forces today, injuring 20 people, including 18 UN peacekeepers from Chad. 8 of the peacekeepers were seriously wounded. The French news agency says it saw a UN report that said 15 mortar shells landed inside and outside the base in the town of Tassalit in northern Mali's restive Kidal region near the Algerian border. The report said camp personnel took shelter in a bunker with 2 Malian civilians wounded in the section of camp where French soldiers stay. Reuters reported that France's military said none of its soldiers were injured. It was the latest in a series of attacks on military outposts in the troubled Sahel region. It was unclear who was responsible. Norway has agreed to accept 6,000 asylum seekers who were evacuated from overcrowded Libyan detention centers to an emergency transit camp in Rwanda. The migrants are among 800 people, mostly from the Horn of Africa, who are waiting in a transit center in Rwanda's Bugesera district. Sweden has already taken 7 of them. Overall, Sweden has agreed to accept a total of 3,000 refugees from UN camps this year, saying it wants to stop the smuggling of migrants across the Mediterranean Sea. Thousands have died while trying to reach Europe in recent years. Last year's international efforts to start negotiations for peace solutions in Libya will be taking place as early as Sunday. A measles outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo has killed more than 6,000 people, most of them children. And mortar rounds rained down on a military base for UN, French and Malian forces today in northern Mali's restive Kidal region. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. In 2019, 2 journalists were killed in Somalia, a low number by Somali standards. More than 50 journalists were arrested, however, and 81 were attacked while doing their job, according to the Somali Journalists Syndicate. The group defends the rights of journalists in the Horn of Africa nations. The group says Somali security agencies stopped journalists 15 times in accessing government offices and areas. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
In a new report, the Somali Journalist Syndicate says the country's politicians, security officers and government workers often interfere with the work of reporters and media professionals in the country. Abdallah Ahmed Mu'min is a Secretary General of the organization.
The report says 81 journalists were physically assaulted during 2019. 7 media houses were shattered in different places in the country. 53 journalists were arrested in different situations, and majority of them were released without charge in a very short time. 3 journalists were wounded, 2 of them sustained gunshot wounds.
Unlike previous years, where dozens of journalists were killed, in 2019 only 2 journalists were killed, both in a hotel attack in Kismayo. The report shows, though, increased threats against journalists, especially those reporting on authorities' problems fighting terror group Al-Shabaab and on human rights issues. Mohamed Bulbul, a Somali journalist, reported on Al-Shabaab's infiltration of businesses and government institutions. Authorities did not like his reporting.
I was threatened by members of government after I investigated and reported about the influence of Al-Shabaab in Mogadishu businesses and even within the government officials in 2019. The government was angry about my report, which I was broadcast on Universal TV, especially in Mogadishu. I went into hiding after security forces arrested to hunt me down, and I couldn't walk for several weeks.
In March, gunmen allegedly dressed in police uniform opened fire at Universal Television. Fortunately, no one was injured. Somali officials deny their officers were behind the attack. In December, the federal state of Hirshabelle in central Somalia closed down an FM radio station, accusing it of spreading misinformation. Authorities briefly detained the owner and some of its staff. Freedom House, an organization that promotes human rights and democracy, ranked Somalia in 2019 as not free. The Somali Journalist Syndicate report said the intense, sometimes violent political competition within Somali society have made many journalists fear for their lives. Mu'min says a lack of law enforcement makes journalists especially vulnerable.
There is a continued enjoyment of the state security forces and state officials with total impunity and the powers that they have to suppress the Somali journalists. And this is not only in Mogadishu, it is in Kismayo, it's happening in Hargeisa, it's happening in Garowe, it's happening in all states in the country where journalists are not able to report any very sensitive reporting like human rights issues. Journalists are not able also to discuss about security-related issues, so the impunity is high.
VOA attempted to reach a Ministry of Information spokesman for a response, but did not get a reply. Somalia has not seen a stable central government since the fall of President Mohamed Siad Barre nearly 30 years ago. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Advocates of press freedom in Nigeria are accusing the government of blacklisting The Punch, a leading national newspaper. In December, the paper criticized President Muhammadu Buhari for allegedly defying the rule of law and illegally detaining citizens. Supporters of the government argue the allegations are vague and lack proof. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
A paid commentary published on January 1 in national newspapers contained President Buhari's Anno New Year goodwill message to Nigerian citizens. For years, the government placed Viad in The Punch, considered the most read newspaper in Nigeria, along with other papers around the country. But this year it didn't, in what activists and press freedom advocates like Raphael Adebayo regard as a form of punishment for The Punch's strongly worded editorial against Buhari in December.
Until The Punch newspaper came out to flay General Buhari's government, they never had a time omitted them from their advertorials. So it is very obvious that they are taking a stand, you know, against the Nigerian people, because the Punch newspaper has taken a stance, you know, to stay with the Nigerian people, to stand with the Nigerian people, and to speak truth to power and to flay misgovernance and bad governance.
The Punch editorial strongly condemned Buhari's alleged refusal to obey the rule of law and the detention of citizens who had been granted bail. The newspaper was lauded by many citizens for its bold standing on the issue, and the government was strongly criticized on Twitter for omitting The Punch in its New Year's advertorial. But government supporters like Abuja resident Yusuf Ali Jafaru say the allegations are vague and lack substance.
I disagree with that opinion. Why I disagree seriously is that so many of these media houses, like I have said before, they don't balance information. They will go ahead and say and feature people who do not have idea about what is going on, but for the fact that they have hatred in their heart against the government, they will say all manner of things just to make sure that their voice is heard.
Officials at the newspaper declined to comment on the matter. Critics say Buhari's All Progressives Congress APC party has shown significant hostility to the press. But Ahaziah Abubakar, the director of news for The Voice of Nigeria, disagrees with the idea that press freedom is threatened in Nigeria.
Well, press freedom in Nigeria, as far as I'm concerned, is a relative term in general terms. We pride ourselves in Nigeria as the freest in terms of press freedom in Africa. By the grace of God, I've been to main economies of Africa, South Africa, Kenya, Egypt, Nigeria, Ghana. And I know the level of freedom that these countries have in terms of press freedom. And I will rate Nigeria higher than them in terms of freedom, particularly during this democratic era.
However, press freedom advocates will be watching to see what happens next. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Sudanese musicians who were banned by the government of ousted President Omar al-Bashir have returned to Sudan to play at a series of New Year concerts in a move seen as symbolic of the changes that have taken place in the country. The Sudanese artists, some of whom were living in the United States, also marked the one-year anniversary of the mass protests that led to Bashir's downfall last April. Naba Mohadin reports from Khartoum.
The Sudanese hip-hop group Nas Jota returned to Sudan for a New Year's Eve concert, their first show at home since 2004, when authorities banned their music for being political. The members of Nas Jota, which means chaotic people in Arabic, were forced to flee after former President Omar al-Bashir's government cracked down on artists who called for protest and new leadership. But since Bashir's ouster last April, Sudan's transitional government has welcomed back dissident artists like Nas Jota's founder, Abba Said.
This is the moment that we were looking for, is that finally I can come back to my country, make life a best for my people with no fear. Before, I couldn't.
The musicians are hailing their return with charity concerts, marking Sudan's Independence Day, January the 1st, the new year, and a new Sudan. Some of the artists, like hip-hop singer Ayman Mao, have been living in the United States and hope to see similar freedoms in Sudan.
In 2020, I wish for the youth in Sudan to have a freedom of expression, freedom of justice, equal rights, especially the artists. I want them to have a Sudan where they can be creative and express themselves.
Returning artists like singer Rasha Sheikhadin acknowledge that many Sudanese are living in tough circumstances.
I'm so excited. The country feels new, although it's still difficult for everybody. Prices are really high. Life is difficult, but people are happy and hopeful and full of plans for the future. It's fantastic.
The concerts also celebrated the one-year anniversary of the December protest against skyrocketing consumer prices that led to Bashir's downfall. Many of the protesters say they listened to the banned music during the month-long demonstrations. Hassan Ismail, who attended the Nas Jota concerts wearing Sudan's flag around his neck, described the music as motivating young people. These songs, Ismail said, have inspired the youth and encouraged them because they describe what was happening. It gave young people motivation and power, he said. The concerts will continue through mid-January to support the relatives of those killed during last year's government crackdowns and to promote peace across Sudan. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. My opening serve on the Sunny Side of Sports is international tennis. Many of the world's top players are in Australia, preparing for the year's first major tournament. The Australian Open begins January 20th in Melbourne. Meanwhile, in Sydney, host Australia and